Hello, and welcome to Dungeons & Drama Nerds, a podcast exploring the intersection of theater and tabletop role-playing games. I'm Percy, here today with Nick.
Hello!
And ensemble member Leo Mock.
Howdy.
This is a momentous occasion because it marks the first of our new series of off-season episodes, which we will be releasing monthly between actual play campaign arcs, which give us an opportunity to kind of dig into topics that we're interested in exploring, but have never quite fit into commentary episodes for our past campaigns. Today, we will be talking about collaborative world building in TTRPGs and how they may resemble world building processes in devised theater projects and vice versa. Our central questions for this episode revolve around what works about effective systems of collaborative world building, what actually makes them collaborative, and how power can inhere in collaborative processes in a way that might undermine their original intentions. So let's get into it. First, a distinction that I think is useful to make is that we're sort of talking about world building in two senses within the context of this episode. The first sort of sense that I think we commonly associate with world building, particularly in the phrase like collaborative world building, is building the fiction of the performance or the campaign or kind of coming up with the world in which the story takes place. I'm going to borrow a definition from Karen Schreier, Evan Turner, and Jessica Hammer's article, World Building in Role-Playing Games, from the Role-Playing Game Studies Transmedia Foundation's anthology. They define world building as, quote, the creation of the fictional universe or world from which the story's perspectives and roles are to emerge, and, quote, the act of designing and constructing believable fictional universes. They define the goal of world building in RPGs as, quote, to establish and define the context for a story or set of stories, regardless of how they will be told, i.e. through a book, game, or LARP. Other goals of world building are establishing the consistency and reliability of the stories, particularly to establish the world's trustworthiness, and it is also to provide a sense of immersion and engagement for the audience. So all of these things are sort of like creating a world that feels as real as possible or has some kind of consistent logic, and sort of defining the context in which a story can take place without actually saying this is what the narrative that takes place in it is.
So in a theater context, this is like the world of the play, potentially, or like the world of the performance that we hope folks gather to come to see.
Yeah, it's the like post-apocalyptic setting of Mr. Burns, like all of the sort of given circumstances that inform what the play, you know, all of the things that explain away why things might be a certain way in the story.
I applaud you for picking a play with an actual post-apocalyptic setting, because I'm sure you were about to be like, it's the post-apocalyptic setting you come up with for Love's Labor's Lost. You know what I mean? Like, that's where I thought that line was going.
I mean, I'm sure there are many intensive world-building processes for people's weird, like, 1920s Twelfth Night or something.
Yeah.
Well, actually, this is a lot of the work I did when I was gender consulting a production of Twelfth Night, was being like, hey, what are the gender norms of this world? Like, what are the expectations that, and, like, the rules that people who are born into this world live with, so that we can, like, establish the rules of the world so that we know how and when we're breaking them.
Yeah, I was doing a joke, but that's actually, yeah, very, I forgot that you literally, like, just recently did 12th Night. We're actually having this conversation, too, with a play that I'm working on right now that is about, it's an adaptation of an ancient Greek tragedy in which there is a lot of, like, lowercase q queerness, but it's, like, unexceptional in the context of that world because of, like, the way that ancient Greece was, although admittedly I'm not, like, an expert on sex in ancient Greece.
It was different.
It was different, but it's we're having a lot of
back in my
day. as I recall, it was different.
We're having a lot of conversations about like what's the extent to which the playwright needs to establish these norms as like a normal thing in the play versus what can we just sort of like, if we treat it as normal, the audience will just assume that it's normal, like that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Does the play need to define like what queerness is to the play and like what these concepts mean specific to the story?
And what I find interesting about that is that I think it speaks to something that I was going to say I a little bit, not take issue with, but like a challenge I would offer to that Schreier, Turner, Hammer definition.
Yeah.
Is is the primacy it gives to the world itself. In that it's, you know, it's, they say the creation of the fictional universe from which all these things are to emerge. And I'm sort of like, well, that is sort of the classical understanding of world building. And it's this, again, just because it is all, it's tabletop role-playing games, therefore rooted in D&D, therefore rooted in Tolkien. And that's really, you know, the kind of Tolkienian, like, you create a world and then tell stories from that world. But I guess a challenge to that, I would say, is that sometimes I think it's the opposite, both in theater creativity and in tabletop role-playing games. You know, sometimes it's like, okay, well, my player wants to play a, you know, robot gunslinger. So I, in the interests of them having a good time, I am going to build a world in which robots and guns and people who sling them exist somehow. You know what I mean? And that's just, which is maybe just putting, like, looking at it from a different angle.
Well, and often I think in theater, that's what table work is sort of extrapolate. Like, we're not given, like, a primer on, I can't think of a good example, but, like, we're not given a primer with the play on, like, this is what the world of surrounding Hedda Gabler was like. We extrapolate details about it from what happens in the play, and we might supplement that with, like, research or whatever, but it's, yeah, like, it's not world first. Although I think a useful piece of context for this, the book in which this article comes from, is that it's very much about, like, transmedia properties and story worlds that are, like World of Darkness-y, or, like, things
Okay.
Like, people make LARPs and games and write books and, like, all of these things about. So I think it is in some ways very, like, let's start with the place where all of these things spring from.
Right. So they're talking about projects that are sort of deliberately world first in their transmedia quality. Right? Like, you've got the World of Darkness, and within that you've got a bunch of different role-playing games and LARPs and, I don't know, anime or something. But that, from that perspective, yeah, world building is a sort of very concrete, the world does underlie it all. In a way that doesn't for, like, my home D&D game.
I think you're right. But I also think they might be sort of trying to at least encompass the possibility of, like, worlds that exists, and then we tell stories out of them, as opposed to, like, we're telling a story and it happens that it implies a world and we sort of understand what bubbles forth.
Yeah.
So it sounds like we're also kind of talking about, like, how we engineer world building, which feels like a world building in and of itself, which I think is, like, the second kind of world building that
incredible,
we can maybe talk about.
Incredible
segue. You like that? You like that segue?
I do. Lest we get hung up on tiny things. I think the other definition of world building that we've sort of arrived at as we prepared for this episode is what is the world of the rehearsal room or the game table? How do we structure that world? How do we build the world of, like, the practices that we engage in to run a campaign or devise a theater project or rehearse a play or what have you? Whether it be we're, like, creating the circumstances under which we do the first kind of world building, or, you know, we're just creating the world in which whatever project we're doing springs forth. And I would wager that how we approach this kind of world building can help determine sort of the success of the first meaning of world building that we talked about, this more, like, fictional sort of practice.
So this kind of world building is outlining, like, who has what kind of power, how can that power be used, like, what are the abilities and constraints of everybody in the room, what are the win conditions of this project, and, like, what kind of project do we want to make together. And that's gonna look so different if you're, like, coming together to do a predetermined scripted play versus if you're, like, we want to devise something and we may or may not have a core theme, right?
Yeah.
So, like, figuring out the building of that world. And I think this is especially important to talk about because so much progress in the world of theater stops on stage. Like, as soon as we have a discussion about, like, how actors are impacted by power or how actors are harmed by power. We're like, great, we did it. Like, we fixed theater. And meanwhile, like, nobody's talking to designers or technicians. Nobody's talking to interns. Nobody is talking to, like, the literary team. And it's like, great, how can we involve everybody in this concept of world building in the rehearsal space?
And I also think, like, even though rehearsing like a scripted play in what we would consider like the normal or standard like thing that we think of when we think about a theater process, like I think all of those things would benefit from intentional world building in terms of like this is what the director's role is, this is how much power the director has, this is what the actors are responsible for, this is what the actors have the capability of changing, this is what the, you know, like so on and so on and so on. But I think we often just sort of take for granted that we all understand what everybody's doing and how much power everybody has, when often I think that, like, I think a lot of friction emerges from that actually not being the case, that we're all aligned.
Well, and people don't want to own the power that they have frequently, I think, which is another issue in theater per se. You know, in regional, in sort of like professional regional theater, roles are fairly well defined from a legal standpoint because many of them are unionized. So, you know, it is like if you look at it, once the show's open, the director is supposed to leave. The stage manager is supposed to enforce the director's vision to the point of like telling an actor, "Hey, you've been doing something different the last 3 nights, and you need to stop." But people, and I've met stage managers who do that. But I think increasingly, people don't want to do that. You know, people as like individual collaborators aren't always comfortable with that being the sort of level of power. I'm thinking primarily of directors here, you know, directors who are like, "Oh, I don't want to be like, you know, the dictatorial whatever, whatever," which is fair and good, but then it creates friction with a system, an infrastructure in which that is the case. I think there are ways to work against that. And I don't think it's really, when we're talking about world building, I think probably what all three of us are interested in, just from what we've chatted about, I think is probably more in the world of like devising, which is a very different thing. But I don't know, just thinking about defining roles, I'm like, you have to define roles, and everyone has to be okay with their place in those definitions.
Well, and I think it's not just roles, but it's also things like I remember when I was doing my apprenticeship, and that, like, I think about this constantly. I worked under a particular stage manager who's like very seasoned, came out of retirement to stage manage for this one particular director. And she runs the rehearsal room in a really, really particular way that I don't think is necessarily a bad thing, but it definitely felt like it created a particular hierarchy. Like, I felt like it makes the operation of power in that space visible in terms of like stage manager as enforcer, which I think is a common reading of the stage manager's role. But like, when we were rehearsing, no one in the room but the director and the actors could talk above a whisper. If you, this was a rehearsal room with like two doors on either side of the room. And if I'm sitting all the way on the right side and I need to go talk to the stage manager on the other side, I have to leave out the one door, go around the back, and come in through the other door. And when you close a door, you have to hold it so that it doesn't make a noise when it closes. Like, all of these things that are making you hyper aware of, like, am I being disruptive? Which, like, it's reasonable to not want things to be disruptive in the rehearsal room, but it feels a little like extreme. And I think about it all the time when I'm like, how do our rehearsal practices and expectations like tangibly sort of make visible how power is operating in that space?
Yeah, and on the flip side, I've worked with a lot of directors, especially young and early career directors, who are like scared of having power, scared of making a decision, scared of being like, no, I have a clear vision. They come in and they're like, I want whatever the actors want to do, whatever the actors are comfortable with. Like, I'm excited for you, especially when there are other clear indicators of power, whether that's like identity-based or systemic or whatever else. A lot of directors who hold extra power are like, oh, no, whatever you want to do. But I think some, like, my little catchphrase that I've been harping on recently is like, structure is a service. Mm-hmm. Like, offering a clear vision, offering expectations, what we might code as win conditions for the actors in terms of like part of this vision, are really helpful. There's so many times when an actor auditions for a project and they're like, I don't know, this is like insert well-known play here. And then they show up and there's like not a clear vision, or the vision is clear and it wasn't like detailed at auditions. And they're like, oh, this is a different project than I thought I was getting into. So like coming in, I think there's a difference between like coming in as the kind of director or like the kind of GM or anything else who is like, this is the way everything has to go all the time. And like, there's a gulf between that and being the kind of director or GM who's like, whatever y'all want to do, I don't know, I'm just here to facilitate you having a good time. And like, there's so many possibilities between and outside those two.
Yeah. I have, first off, this is a sidebar, but I just want to say, I love asking what are the win conditions for this project. I like, I'm maybe going to take that forward in my theatrical practice because I love Damn that. It.
Right, and everybody can have different ones. Like, you know, the business side is going to have its win conditions, and the creative side is going to have its win conditions, and, like, how do those things work in tandem? Anyway, you go ahead.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to say I had a really useful kind of foundational experience that shifted, that made me think about this when I was a young director, and I was like, I want to do devising thing, and this particular project I was attempting to do sort of a devised adaptation of was also of the Euripides play Hecuba. So I was also very like in my head about, because I was like, this is a play about like, this is a play about women and sexual violence and et cetera, et cetera. And here I am as a cis dude. And I was working with a cast on sort of devising a new version of it, and had the great good fortune to have Esther Coe, who is on our arc of Kids on Bikes.
Yes, Esther.
Yay.
Esther say to me during one rehearsal, like, she was just like, Nick, I think I just am not sure what we're trying to do, and it would be helpful if you gave me a like clear direction in this moment. And I was kind of like, oh, okay, right, and had that sort of exact connection that you were just articulating, Leo, of like, right, if I'm going to call myself a director at all in this project, then it is on me to actually, like, to not just be like, okay, let's, like, fuck around with movement exercises, but actually articulate some kind of goal and vision that we're working toward. And I think, and like you said, I think a lot of young directors and playwrights, I found this with playwrights too, which is interesting, I think, don't want to do that, are scared of or uncomfortable taking on that authority.
And I think a lot of it comes from the fact that like we're having so many more conversations now about like how power has been misused and abused, specifically by directors and by artistic leaders. And so a lot of people who are coming into this industry in the last, you know, 10-ish years are like, I want to be the opposite of that.
Right.
Yeah. This is making me think, I've been thinking a lot about, I want to pivot us to sort of the question of like, is something automatically good because it is collaboratively done?
Right.
But the, my one other concession to academia is that I took a feminist epistemologies class last year. And we read this article by an anthropologist named Judith Stacy, who it was called, I don't remember at this moment. It was like, can you write a feminist ethnography was the question she was asking. Like, is it possible to do ethnography in a feminist way? And she's arguing that it is impossible to do a feminist ethnography because there is inequality that is like automatically kind of structured into the relationship between a researcher and the object of their research. Mm-hmm. And that like attempting to kind of like ameliorate that or weaken that or do something about that inevitably like changes the nature of the project. Because she's kind of like, well, I guess you could like go and like do these interviews with people and then just publish what they said unedited or unstructured by you. But A, that's kind of disingenuous because you're a researcher who has a question that you're pursuing. Like you have a reason that you wanted to do this and you need to be like honest about what that is. And also like inevitably the act of you showing up to talk to these people changes what they would say.
Yeah.
And all of these things. So she's basically like, there's nothing we can do about it. You just have to deal with the fact that what you're doing is a little bit unequal and like be as transparent as you can about your motivations and why you're doing things and all of that.
Well, and inevitably, if you publish, even if you publish these unedited transcripts, the person who gets credit for that is you, the person who like publishes them, not the people who say the things. Typically, so maybe somebody reads it and is like, "Oh, this person I interviewed is amazing. I gotta go hunt them down in Chicago or wherever." But
yeah, and like what we've just been talking about is I think we provided a lot of good examples of situations in which like it's really tempting to sort of say, "Oh, I don't want to misuse power." Or wield power in a way that harms other people, and therefore I will simply not have any power at all. And like, A, you still do. You're just choosing not to use it, or you're being kind of disingenuous about the ways in which you're using it. And two, a point that you raised when we were like starting to talk about this episode, Leo, is that like sometimes if you're like an actor, you just want to go to rehearsal and be told like, this is what we're doing.
You just want to go to work.
Yeah.
You can just go to work. I experience this when I'm doing intimacy choreography. I'm a very collaborative, like I want to go in, and the way I best like to work is when I can go in and say like, okay, I'm noticing that there's a beat here where something needs to happen that tells this kind of story. Do you have an idea of what that could be? Or I'll like give options. And like, even though that's my value, I had to stop and think like, oh, how does it feel for an actor to like look at their scene partner and say like, this is the thing that I want to act out with you. And how might they fear that that could be read? Is that being read as like, I want to actually do this thing with you, blah, blah, blah. And so like getting to the point where you're offering the option of like, hey, the way I like to work is collaboratively. If you want me to just like give you a couple of options or just like tell you what I think would work here, please let me know. Just tell me, like, let me know if you want me to just tell you what to do here, basically. Which is like, it feels so anathema to all these conversations about consent. But also, like, that's consent too. When someone's like, I just want to show up at work and not have to think too hard about this.
Right, yeah. What I've consented to is arriving and using my craft in the way I'm directed. Mm-hmm. To like,
which
to
doesn't
create a performance,
and there's a way that you can build into your rehearsal practices that you can build the world of your rehearsal room where actors are totally empowered to say, actually, that doesn't feel good to me. Yeah. I don't want to do that.
Exactly.
Right, and they still can get direction. Like they receive the direction and then feel empowered to be like, but actually, 99% of the time, yes, but this particular time, I don't want to do that.
Or even if it's just like, that doesn't make sense to me, can you explain it? Or that doesn't make sense to me, can you try something else? Like, it isn't even about safety always. Sometimes it's just like, I don't understand that.
Yeah, exactly. Like, boundaries can be personal in a whole bunch of different ways, right? They can be physical, they can be emotional, they can be cultural, they can be professional. But boundaries can also be around, like, no, I need to understand what this means for the character so that, like, if I, as an actor, am showing up and, like, being the advocate for my character's story, I need to understand the argument that I'm making for them if this is, like, the choice that they are making, that I am making for them.
And we make a lot of jokes in both tabletop game spaces and in rehearsal rooms where, you know, there's, like, the, I think, trope of the, like, conceited actor who's like, well, that's not what my character would do. But sometimes, like, that's not like, I don't think that's what my character would do. Can you explain to me why you think it is?
Yeah.
Or that's not the vision that I had for this character. Can we, like, find the choice that's in between? Right? Because I think that this is also where, like, going back a little bit to our conversation about, like, what power do actors or players in games have? So much of it is around, like, creative autonomy, because the direction of like the overarching story or the world and the direction of the character are so intertwined that sometimes like the freedom to make whatever choice you want to make for your character impacts the world or vice versa. And so, like, how do we exchange how those decisions are made?
Yeah, and I think I've noticed in at least tabletop spaces, but also in the way that some people who are primarily devisors talk about devising, there is this assumption that, like, doing things as collaboratively and consensus-based as possible is always inherently good. Oh. And I think, A, it really depends on how you structure, because some people are not good at doing things collaboratively in practice, or aren't prepared for the reality of, like, doing consensus-based work, which takes a really long time and is exhausting. Like, the day that we're recording this, we played our first session of Our Haunt last night, which is incredibly collaborative, and, like, I find it a more tiring play experience than, like, showing up to play D&D and the DM is giving me situations and I react to them, because I don't have to think about it as much.
100%.
And I'll also say on that, Percy, like, we were playing that, and even though it's specifically structured to have no leader, I think the rest of us were kind of like, oh, Percy knows this game better, so we're going to kind of, like, we're not going to say that Percy's the leader of this game, but we're all going to quietly know it in a way that, like, in a way that felt weird. And I was like, oh, it's kind of weird that we're not saying this out loud, right?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I do think as the session progressed, everybody got more comfortable with, like, oh, I can just do stuff. But yeah, no, I also went into it knowing, like, I have to structure this a little bit.
Yeah. And I think that, like, going to this question of, like, is something inherently, like, better, which I would also question, like, what does better mean? Like, is it better work? Is it, like, more just and equitable and fair? Like, mm-hmm. What's that? But also, like, even when we go into something thinking, like, this is fully collaborative, there's no leaders, there's no power, there's always going to be power.
Yeah.
Like, we can't not make that exist. Like, there are so many. Whenever I'm part of a devising process, I jokingly call myself, like, professionally, I'm a service top, because every time I'm part of a creative process where I don't have a clearly defined role, I'm, like, the timekeeper, I'm the agenda setter, uh-huh. I'm the, like, so what are our goals for today, y'all? Even because that's, like, something that's important for me to have, and it feels like a service to the group so that we can all be on the same page. So even though there are maybe other people who are more, like, who are making more creative decisions, or there are other people who are, like, in leadership in different aspects, maybe somebody else tends to be the person who's like, I have a really good playlist for this, right? Everybody's, like, holding power in different ways. And unless we name it, it's just going to kind of exist as this unsaid undercurrent where we're like, oh yeah, this is just the thing that they're doing. And at what point does, like, something become a task, become more or less collaborative, when those assumptions are made?
And I think often not naming it makes it so that it is, we become less okay with, like, admitting that something isn't working, because we haven't said out loud, like, this is what we're doing. There's no sort of, like, acknowledgement, however formal or informal, of, like, this person usually does this, this person usually does this, like, this, these are the roles that we've agreed to take on, and we know that they might change, so therefore we become sort of attached to what this is, and we sort of feel like, oh, this is what we've committed to, and therefore we must continue.
There was a project I worked on where I just, at some point I realized that somebody should be taking photos of, like, the rehearsal process for social media and stuff, and so I was just like, oh, I realized this is a need we have, I guess I'll start taking photos. And then I did all that, and I realized, oh, there aren't any photos of me. No. Right? And so there are ways that, like, even taking on a position of power, like, that's not an inherently awesome thing for the person doing it. That's not a, like, ha-ha, I have this power. Even though I had, like, the decision-making around what photos were taken, that also meant that I had to, like, sacrifice another part of my work in this project.
Yeah, I was reading a book recently it's called Practical Anarchism, and it is, like, about, like, affinity group organizing and stuff like that. Mm. But one thing that it talks about that I think is also a factor is that if we don't name these things, or if even if we aren't like openly sort of saying like, oh, I've noticed this thing, I think we should all be more cognizant of the need to take photos. You know what I mean? Like if we're not at least sort of openly saying this is a thing that I've noticed, who wants to do it or whatever. It also becomes hard, not only, like, I don't know, I think it makes it hard to sometimes realize, because I've been in devising processes where I've realized, like, relatively early on that it's just, like, not a good group. Like, we're just not gelling. Like, it's just, like, we just don't work together well. And I think often if you don't have the language for, like, what everyone is doing, it's really hard to acknowledge that because nobody wants to be a spoil sport. But there is like no worse feeling than being in a particularly like a really collaborative theater process or a tabletop game that is not working and nobody wants to say like this feels bad and isn't fun.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Especially when it's like you don't want to. Naming a problem can feel like highlighting what a person is bad at, or in a way that feels gross. And as here's what it is that when you have a director, when you have a stage manager, it's their job to do that. Yeah. But when you're in a collaborative process, everybody's like, we're specifically in a collaborative process because we didn't want it to be someone's job to tell us what we're doing wrong.
Oh my God, that's so right.
Yep. Yeah.
We specifically chose this because we didn't want someone to take this job of naming what's not working, and now one of us has to do it, and none of us wants to.
Which is why I think the practice of, like, world building in the sense of, like, deciding how your room operates in a really open way is really, really important, because it's you're able to say, like, inevitably in those conversations, someone will probably bring up, what happens if I have a problem with how someone else is doing something? How do we want to handle that? I want to also, I think, pivot us to this question, because we're already talking sort of about how power is held in devising spaces specifically, and maybe start thinking about what structures kind of lend themselves to operating more collaboratively. Because I think another trap of devising, or when people sort of, like, stereotype trope of devising of like we're all in a room and we're gonna throw out ideas and like make something together that is completely from scratch generated from the meeting of our minds. I have found, and I know this because I can admit that I am a person who is very uncomfortable with silence and is often the person who, if no one else is saying anything, I will find something to say. I think devised projects that sort of operate in this way of like we're trying to do everything completely collaboratively without talking about what that means end up making work that is shaped primarily by the person who feels most comfortable speaking in a large group or throwing out ideas or is the person who will say something because they want to break the silence.
Yeah, 100%. And this is such a weird observation. I don't have huge experience in devising. One of the reasons I was interested in this question of world building is because in my experience, the devising projects that start from actual scratch, like not adapting a piece from form A to form B, but from like, we're going to get together and like make a theater piece about what we don't know. Those, in my limited experience, those pieces are least successful when they're most verbal. Which is why I was wondering about world building, because I was like, the ones I've experienced and seen, if you're adapting something, it's different because you have sort of source material that acts as this thing that everybody kind of gets to equally bounce off of. But when it's like, we're just getting together to make something, I think usually if there is a sort of verbal, okay, what world is it? What is it going to be like? Like, let's improvise a scene together. That very much does tend to get dominated by people talking. And the most exciting both processes and I think results I've seen from that sort of process happen instead when it's devising like from the body, from movement, and kind of nonverbal places like that.
Or even from like that's an answer to we're all question, bringing but... in like a photograph, or we're all bringing in an item.
Yeah,
I really appreciate, and I think that sometimes performances get stuck in talking because the rehearsal gets stuck in talking, where we're like in that circle of like, oh, but what about the nuance of this? Oh, and it'd be so cool if this happens. And like, those are such fun, energizing conversations. And so we don't want to stop them. I think the way I do it is I set a timer and I'm like, look, it's going to be nobody's fault that this conversation ends. Like we're not going to get to a like, okay, we've had this conversation and now we know what the performance is. It's just, we're going to talk for 7 minutes and then we're going to put on this playlist that we made last night. And we're just going to like explore the stories that we're talking about in our bodies. And we're just going to like see what comes out for the 4 minute duration of this song. Mm-hmm. And then we can have another 7 minutes of saying like, how did that feel? You know, mm-hmm. but like, really clearly establishing the like kind of rules, the kind of mechanics of like the play that we're doing together. And I do think it can and should be play when it's like making theater, can really help folks understand like, what is the point of what we're doing right now? Are we talking to get like generative? Are we talking to decide on something at this moment? Are we talking to like sort out like some options that we have? What is it? And then just like get up and do it.
Yeah. And I think this leads me to the question of like, the like broad question is like, is there a way to have any kind of like devising process or TTRPG campaign that is like genuinely and truly without a leader TM? Or does like a leader inevitably emerge? And what does that mean and look like? But I also think in your self-definition as like a service top of devising, like, I don't know that that's leadership. I think it's facilitation. And I think like, I'm curious about the distinction between those things.
Oh, what's the difference? See, here's the fun. I'm so nonprofit pilled that I'm like, you say that. And I'm like, yeah, a facilitator is just what we call ourselves when we're leading and we're uncomfy with leadership.
With leadership. Yes, absolutely. Well, it's
That's so fair.
This is like the thing that we, well, and so then I'll like, okay, I'll actually buy into the question and I'll put my bias aside.
For clarity, I'm at peace with them being the same thing.
I think it shares quality with leadership. And I think that it also means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. We can also look at the root of the word, and like facile means easy. So like to make something easier, to make something smoother, to like make a process feel more manageable for everybody. But then I think we fall into a bit of a trap of like, to whose standards?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The right? Only...
Yeah. No, go ahead.
I was just going to, one on the not-for-profit pilled, I was going to say, it's fascinating to me how many, like, artistic directors and that sort of thing love the first chapter of Audrey and Marie Brown's Emergent Strategy. Like, I can't tell you how many, like, theater manager types have been like, you gotta read, like, this. Specifically, I'm thinking in, like, courses, I was in there, like, here's what I'm assigning from this book, the first chapter, and I'm like,
yes.
Have you read
fascinating
the book?
Where you're choosing to stop this. But I was going to say, the experience I've had, I actually am not convinced that, like, facilitation and leadership can be different if what you want to be is, like, a stakeholder in the project. The only experiences I have had where I had a facilitator that felt kind of generative and different from leadership was in situations where the facilitation was almost more like mediation. Not mediation exactly, because that's a very kind of loaded word, but, you know, where it was like, oh, we're trying to re-examine our, you know, curriculum or values or whatever from an anti-racist lens, say, and we have brought someone in who is like not a part of our institution, who has like no relationships with any of us, no kind of stake in the details of the outcome, but whose only job here is to like help us have that conversation. That I think is a sort of meaningfully different thing from leadership. But if you are one of the people having that conversation, I'm not sure you can be that kind of facilitator. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
That's yes. And mm-hmm. I had a professor when I was in school who very much believes in dramaturgy as facilitation. And she's talking very specifically about like the director is in the room, leading the room with their creative vision. And the dramaturg is facilitating the process by making it easier for us to sort of all be on the same page about what's happening. And I, because of my like talking to her about this and stuff like that, I think a lot about my work as a dramaturg as being like clippy, where it's like, hey, I noticed that you're trying to do this.
Yeah.
Like, hey, do you think that like, is this helpful? Like, is this kind of what it like? That's a lot of how I view the work of dramaturgy in my personal artistic practice. And I think of that as facilitation. I think the distinction for me lies in like having a creative vision that you are executing. But I also think it is true what you're pointing out, that like often quote unquote facilitators have a creative vision and have an opinion about what they're talking about. And it can be really easy to kind of get lost in the sauce and start steering the conversation you are facilitating towards what you want it to be. Not even in like a malicious way, but just like,
yeah,
it's inevitable if you have a stake in it too.
Well, yeah. And I think any, you know, in any process like this, everyone is going to have opinions. Like it's, you know, nobody can be 100% objective and like just a facilitator. But speaking to that, you know, vision, Percy, I feel like I have met some other dramaturgs who would be very like upset at that articulation of what dramaturgy is, and you know, and I understand that, and I think there are other ways to work. And circling back to some of what Leo was saying earlier, though, that's not the worst thing. You know, I was told when I was in grad school one time, a professor said to me, Nick, you know, your superpower is that you can disengage. And that is, you know, now grad school is a very stressful time, but they were talking about exactly that, of like, some folks I know would go into processes and would get so like wrapped up in the fact that the process wasn't what, not even the process, that the project was not what they like would want it to be in their ideal vision. And sort of like, well, if you're working in this sort of regional theater model, that's not the dramaturg's job. And like, maybe you don't want to be a dramaturg in that context, which fine. But, you know, the great thing for me about being a dramaturg is I get paid, I get to go, I get to give my little notes. I, you know, try to be as helpful as I can and make the process better and make the end result better. And I have never once seen a review of a production that was like, this show would have been great except for the fucking dramaturg. Fucking, you know what I mean? Like, and like, this is the thing about leadership, is it's
a sloppy ethnography.
Yeah. But this is the thing about leadership. It comes with both reward and risk. Mm. You know, directors get blamed if a show goes badly. Playwrights get blamed if a show goes badly. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that is a kind of benefit sometimes of that, of those kind of clear roles, is it's like, well, if I've given the note that I think this is a bad idea three times and other people are unwilling to change it, at the end of the day, nobody's going to be like, that was Nick's fault.
Yeah.
But I also think there's a lot of like stuff about like invisibility versus visibility of like power and authority and all of these things. And I think the thing to like name is that like facilitation is also a kind, like if you are the person keeping time and you are the person taking notes and you are the person who is trying to stay aware of like, oh, this person has something to say but hasn't been able to break into the conversation, so I'm going to turn to them and say, what do you think?
Yeah.
Like there is a, you That's are power. You are, yeah, that is the operation of power. But I also think what we've sort of been like circling around is like, power is not a bad thing necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I think facilitators have the most power when they have like institutional buy-in. Mm-hmm. Because there are times when a theater will hire a cultural consultant, a theater will hire someone because they're like checking that box, but nobody's actually going, like, or very few people, especially the people with the most power in the institution, may not buy into it fully. So if there's like in there having like trying to facilitate a beautiful, rich conversation and people aren't buying into it, then I'm not going to say like, oh, facilitation has inherent power to it. And like going back to this idea of facilitators like having opinions, I think it's, I was going to say it in a really hot take way, but I'm going to tone it down just a little bit. For me, it is best practice for facilitation to include objectives, to include win conditions, if I may, of both for me to be able to leave and think like, did I do my job well? I just asked a bunch of questions. And for me to be able to go in and like know what I'm there to do, mm-hmm. right? Like I facilitate a lot of conversations about like consent and sex. And if I just waltz in and I'm like, I have no opinions, I have like no objectives, it's gonna be tougher to handle that conversation or encourage conversation. And I can also admit my standpoint as part of facilitation and just say like, yeah, this is like what I believe, this is what I practice, but also we're here to discuss like what works best for you or what works best for this story or what works best for this organization.
Yeah, like these things are always true whether we name them or not, and they will always be a part of how we approach things because it's what we believe and it's the values that we're operating from and it's all these things. So it's sort of like, let's just say, because like you're in the room for a reason, the theater hired you for a reason, or you wanted to play the game that you're GMing for a reason, or mm-hmm. any number of things. Like there is, you have some kind of buy-in to it and some kind of opinion about it. And in fact, I think it's often better to just say, I wanted to play Arhant because I like ghosts and because I, you know what I mean? Like it's, like, let's not pretend that we are a neutral entity in the space.
Yeah. And like using the example of Arhant, like I want to play this room because this room sounds like a fun time to play. Like I want to play this specific playbook because of like, frankly, the powers it gives me and like the choices it gives me and the things I get to do with it. And like when you are guiding, when you're playing the room, like, yes, you have a position of power. You have a position of like interim leadership at that point, and you're facilitating. And like a lot of the power comes from, it's kind of like, if I'm really good at hiking, mm-hmm. if I'm like a very outdoorsy guy and I'm on a hike with somebody who's not a very outdoorsy person, but I'm letting them lead. I'm like, great, which way, which trail do you want to go down? And they're like, I want to go that way. And I'm like, great, just so you know, that way is like a pretty tough hike. It's going to be about 3 hours. It's pretty like steep elevation. Is that still something you want to do? Mm-hmm. And they're like, no, I want to go that way. and then I'm like, cool, that way's a little bit muddy because it just rained, but it looks like you're wearing good boots for it. It's a bit Gandalf, like putting the choice in the hands of Frodo, being like, you want to go the mountain, you want to go the mines.
Yeah, and then you Clippy and you say, it looks like you're trying to hike only for a couple of hours. This is what I would recommend.
Yeah. So we established at the start of this process that we were maybe only looking to hike for like a 1.5-2 hour situation. Is that still something you want to do, or you want to try to go for the 3 hour? And we can always turn back and I'll let you know when we hit about the point when it would be a full 2 hours to get back. Right. And so it's like, I think I personally like facilitating best when I'm like encouraging others to lead and encouraging confidence in decision-making in others. And I'm just like giving information. I'm like offering opinions. I'm offering the expertise I have, etc.
Yeah. Or like what I was trying to do a lot in Arhant is just like ask questions of like, what do you think your character is doing? Where, you know, but Something that I'm thinking about, a conclusion that I'm drawing from our conversation, is that, yes, absolutely, in sort of quote-unquote collaborative spaces, we can wield power in a way that does harm to others by being too controlling, by sort of using our power to assert authority in a way that doesn't feel good. But also sort of not using the power that you have or pretending that it doesn't exist and sort of stepping back and saying, I'm not going to do anything, can also be really harmful, because I'm thinking a lot about like we talk a lot about activity and passivity of audiences, mm-hmm. but yeah. Like often audiences show up and they want to watch something and they want to draw their own conclusions about it and they want to talk to their friends about it afterwards. Like, you have to scaffold things like interactivity or immersivity in a way that is like a genuine invitation, because often, like, I don't know, I've seen many situations and been the audience participant in many situations in which, like, there's not really a clear vision for why somebody from the audience is a part of this. And you're just kind of there and, like, you don't know what's going on because you don't, like, you weren't a part of the of the process, and you don't know what to do.
And or worse, when there's no invitation at all and they're just like, oh, we will just arbitrarily select an audience member to do this participatory thing.
Yeah, like being expected to collaborate without being given a structure in which to do it that supports you is also harmful.
I was just talking to someone about how, like, the whole, like, wear a certain colored armband to indicate how you want to be interacted with, or, like, you know, have some sort of accessory to show this is how I want to be treated in this context. I'm like, oh, cool, we're just bringing the hanky code to theater.
Yeah, which I love.
Which I love. I think that, like, we could make so many cool safety tools from the hanky code.
I think we've said this, but just a thing that I'm circling around is that it seems to me like a conclusion I'm drawing from this is that the structure actually matters. The specifics of the structure and the, like, power or hierarchy, which I guess mm-hmm. is just structure plus power, matters a lot less than everybody being clear on what it is. And, like, holding response, like, I don't know, that maybe that's too sweeping a statement, but, you know, we've been talking about, like, the importance of accepting the responsibility of power if you are in a kind of hierarchical one, and also of, it's trickier with non-hierarchical, like, processes, but I think they're too acknowledging that, like, the goal is for it to be collaborative, and also acknowledging when it's like, oh, maybe I've been talking for a very long time.
Well, I think the difference is in a, like, non-hierarchical organizing, rehearsal, creation, whatever, is not saying we are doing away with power. It's saying power right. is shared among all of the people present. And the act of doing that requires us to name, this is the way in which this is the thing that I am responsible for, the thing that mm-hmm. I am in charge of. And then you say all of these things out loud, and then you look, is this relatively even? And as you work, you pay attention to, like, oh, do I feel like this one person has sort of an unequal amount of authority over stuff? And is that okay? Or do we want to sort of try and even things back out? Like, it's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think information is a big part of what the structure looks like, and, like, how power exists in the room. Like, if I'm because I've been thinking about it a lot, if I'm playing Bluebeard's Bride and, like, I don't know that I can leave the room, I don't know that I have exit moves, then, like, I'm gonna have a harder time, like, taking ownership of the game, because what I want doesn't feel accessible to me because I don't know the rule. And so I think so much of, like, how power shows up in these spaces is knowing the rules.
Yeah.
Okay. Of, like, what can't, oh my gosh, a question I get, or not a question, a discussion I have so many times is, like, hey, you know you can ask for this, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you might not get it, but you can. It is totally within professional expectations for you to ask for this.
Yeah. That is so true. And it's so much of, like, the way we talk about everything is, yeah, like, if you don't know that something is possible, you can't have it, you know.
Yeah.
this is maybe too much of a left turn, so
turn the car.
But well, so what this has been, I'm just thinking back to world building, mm-hmm. specific in its sort of fictive sense, and a thing that I thought of, because I'm a basic dramaturgy bitch, is Eleanor Fuchs' essay, E.F.'s Visit to a Small Planet. If you're not familiar with it, go bother a dramaturg in your life. They have a photocopy of it.
They've read it, like, for every class they've ever taken.
Yes, they've been required to read it 7 times.
Oh my god.
And we're probably introduced to it before that. But for those who don't know, it's this essay from, I think, the late 90s or early 2000s, by a dramaturg, Eleanor Fuchs, that's about treating a play as a world.
Mm-hmm.
And the connection I'm making is that so this essay assumes a sort of fixed text. And I think it's important to note that it is about that. It is not a guide for writing a play, although people sometimes treat it as one, but I think that's a bad idea. But it assumes a fixed text, and what I'm thinking about is the way that then in rehearsal, you know, it asks you to do the work that, or to do the kind of work that you should be doing in table work on very mm-hmm. fundamental levels, just questioning, like, what is the weather like in this world? What is time like in this world? What is the passage of time like? What is the geography, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm just thinking, you know, in many ways, when you have a fixed text, that is the world building. So I'm wondering if there's a way to get at, like, rather than world building, which has very sort of authorial connotations to me, if there's something to world discovery as a process or something like that instead, that is, you know, collaborative processes that are less about, we're going to, like, build this thing up with a plan and a vision and blah, 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 and a little bit more flexible and malleable and, you know, more based in questions rather than, I mean, I think this is, we had a list here of some, like, collaborative systems for world building in games. I feel like a lot of them are questions, are like question based. Am I right about that? Kids on Bikes is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Kids on Bikes is specifically questions that the GM poses to the players. And Belong Outside Belonging and The Quiet Year book, which is also, I think, in some ways a Belong Outside Belonging vibe, are, I think, more conversational. Or I think The Quiet Year operates on the basis of, like, I am speaking something into existence, and in fact discourages you from discussing it. You're just sort of like, I said this thing, and everybody knows that this is now true, and then this other person will say this other thing. And we're...
Although a lot of the... In that case, the game sometimes, if I'm recalling correctly, the game sometimes asks questions.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have an yes. oracle deck. So sometimes what you're speaking is a response to, you know, the prompt will be, yes. like, a community member finds something unsettling outside the town. What is it?
Yeah, yes, yeah, totally.
Maybe this is because I'm in such a, like, pastoral frame of mind from The Quiet Year specifically, but a phrase that comes to mind is world cultivating.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, I love that.
Because it's less about, like, I think when I hear discovery, what comes into my mind is, like, I push apart the limbs and there's a world there.
Yes.
You know? And like, that's totally not how you meant it when you said it. And that's just, like, what's in my mind. But when I think about what these worlds do, it does, or what this kind of world making does, it is very much a, like, okay, here's this, like, plot. I'm going to add these fertilizers. I'm going to amend the soil in this way. I'm going to plant these seeds. I'm going to build these kind of barriers. And it has a very, like, life making sense to me, in that we are establishing what the world needs to thrive, and we're establishing, like, what the world needs to grow and potentially become unruly, and, like, how we treat that unruliness. And it's not, like, fully fleshing out right at the top.
What I like about that metaphor too is that there is like a balance within it of like an openness to like what is already there, what is required in order to, but also it requires you to have sort of an idea in mind of what you want it to be in the end. And maybe you are, and there's an openness to like, this might not be possible given the parameters that we have. But you go in sort of saying, oh, I'm working with what I have, but also there is something that I'm trying to achieve. Mm-hmm. And I think that the both of those things are important. Yeah. Which is why I think Belong Outside Belonging games like our haunt sort of tell you to orient around like, oh, I've decided this is kind of what I want my character to sort of pursue. So we can be working towards that as opposed to just sort of doing stuff and seeing what comes up, which is, I think, a pitfall a lot of devising processes fall into, of sort of being like, we're paying such close attention to what emerges that we forget that, like, it's okay to have an idea in mind of what you want to be doing.
A pitfall a lot of devising processes and a lot of Belonging Outside Belongings games fall into, I would say. I feel like our haunt is pretty well struck. Our haunt, I think, is perhaps unusually well structured within that movement, or I'll just say unusually structured.
Yeah. And I think another pitfall is like being very realistic with our hoped outcomes, both for gaming and for theater. I've been in so many devising processes where it's like, our goal is that everybody leaves this theater and changes their mind. our goal is that everybody leaves this theater and takes like this political action, or now believes this thing to their core. And it's like, great, how actionable is that? And how much are we setting ourselves up to like feel bad when that thing does not happen? And so like, what are the ways for theater we can have really measurable outcomes? Sometimes it can feel like, I don't ever want anyone to feel hamstrung by like, oh, we're thinking too small. But even just, I saw a production of Wolf Play at Company One in Boston. And like afterwards they had a survey that was just like, hey, how much did you know about transracial adoption before you saw this play? How much do you feel you know about it afterward? Do you feel encouraged to go and learn more about it? And like, if there's something that we can do to just like get an idea of like, hey, what do we want people to leave with? What questions do we want people to leave with? I think that's easier than being like, everybody's gonna leave this theater a new person. In the same way that like, when we enter a game, like I remember playing Thirsty Sword Lesbians and like having all these really grandiose, like, this is the arc my character's gonna go through. It's gonna be about unmaking and remaking and unmaking the world again. And it's like, actually, we're gonna have a really silly enemies to lovers, and like that's gonna be close. And like getting a little bit more grounded. And a lot of that's about understanding the container and like understanding the timelines, understanding the, I don't want to say like constraints or limitations, but like the capacity of what we're playing.
Yeah.
And I think it's also just about like, let's be honest about what is happening.
Yeah.
Because I think I'm thinking now about, there's like a particular exercise in the Viewpoints book by Anne Bogart and Tina Landau that I have a bit, it's a big pet peeve of mine, because it's this exercise where you're all running in a circle and you're supposed to simultaneously change directions. And it's supposed to be imperceptible. Like there is not supposed to be a perceivable like leader of that. And it's like, you'll all feel when to jump, or you'll all feel when to change directions. And I'm like, that's not true. That's someone not is going true. To decide. And you and Bogart and Tina Landau know that that's, there is not like a pulse that will emanate that everyone will act upon at the same time. It's actually just about paying attention to what's going on around you such that you can respond really quickly. And let's just be honest about the fact that like that's what's happening.
There's so many theater exercises that are in this foundation of like trust. of like, and trust for people that like you don't know at all and like have no reason to trust. But so many exercises are just like, everybody find a partner. And there's, you know, like that's the only thing you hear until you're face to face with someone. Or like, everybody lay down on the floor. It's like, what are we about to do? What's about to happen? I think like one of the best, one of the most fulfilling devising exercises I've ever done was a similar thing where it's like, you're all going to know when the scene starts. Like, like you're all going to get in position on the stage. You're going to breathe together and you'll just know when it starts. And so we all got up there and we took a big breath and we were like, trying to look at each other without looking at each other. And simultaneously, we all just like lifted our hands and our shoulders up into a shrug. And we all just went, I don't know. And it was such a beautiful admission of like, what was happening in that moment was that we were all clueless. We didn't have a clear win condition. We just had this really vague prompt that was meant to like surprise us in some way. And to be fair, it did. And like, then we did have like an interesting scene that came from that. But it came because we had to admit, like, we don't know what we're doing or why we're doing this.
Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of, like, I think that's a really good example of the relationship between these two kinds of world building that we've been talking about, which is that I think the like fictional world building is really, really shaped by the structure through which it comes about. Mm-hmm. And I think we talk about how we build worlds through questions or through images or exploration or whatever, but we don't often talk about like, how are we facilitating that process? Like, what are the practices that we are engaging in order to do that, and what do those afford us, and what are we not afforded by doing particular things?
Mm-hmm.
Any final thoughts about collaborative world building and devising in TTRPGs?
So many, you know, like this is such a rich topic, and I love that this started in just like like a Slack subthread that went way too long. this was very much just us being like, wait, and what about, wait, and what about, and like, I love this. Yeah, I love talking about this.
Yeah, well, thank you for joining us to talk about it. I loved that Slack subthread at like 11 p.m. of you and me just being like, and this, and this, and this, fire.
I was gonna
emoji,
say, it was a wild
emoji
thing to watch.
I'd be like typing and then I'd see a new message and I'd be like, heart react.
Well, now that you listeners have been given a peek behind the curtain.
This is the collaborative world building process of Dungeons and Dragons. Mm-hmm.
It's just a lot of loving Slack messages.
True. And the Sonic Dab emoji that I use on everything. Well, I think we'll leave it there. Thank you all very, very much for joining us for this off-season episode. We will see you next month with more
content. Of something.
With more of something.
TBD.
Dungeons and Dragons is produced by Nicholas Orvis and Percival Hornack, and this episode was mixed and edited by Percival Hornack. Our core ensemble are Todd Brian Backus, Giovanni Camagno, Anthony Sertel-Dean, Christopher Dirksen, Ben Ferber, Corey Flores, Miyako Gavia, Tess Huth, Romana Isabella, John John Johnson, CJ Linton, C. Meeks Meeker, Leo Mock, Dex Fan, and Tristan B. Willis. If you'd like to help us continue exploring the intersections of theater and tabletop role-playing games, consider leaving us a review on your podcast app of choice or supporting us, and getting access to our patron-only bonus content at patreon.com/dungeonsanddramanerds. You can find our social media and website links, including our cast bios, at the link tree in our show notes. And be sure to tune in soon for another episode of Dungeons and Drama Nerds.